The following program was produced by an independent community producer. The opinions expressed do not necessarily reflect those of the ECAT staff or board of directors.
Giving a voice to the voiceless, pulling stories out of the shadows and putting them under the spotlight, making sure that each person is valued and cared for. This is Humanity First with Peter Evers, presented by BAMZ.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Humanity First. It is the first one of 2024, and we have a special treat in store for us. In a few minutes, we're going to be interviewing Chief Justice John Broderick, who is somebody that I've worked with over the last seven or so years, who has done some incredible work with kids and raising the conversation around mental health and normalizing some of the conversations that over the years have been very difficult to have and people have been very reticent about speaking about. We're changing the face of mental health in our country. It's happening. It's not happening quickly enough, but John is going to really speak about how he has gone about that in the last 7 years or so. It's also been an interesting week in terms of public figures speaking out and talking about their struggles with mental illness. Meet the Press, and you can see this if you Google it, and Meet the Press, Senator John Fetterman spoke so openly in a 46-minute interview this week, which was just really amazing. He is an incredibly brave person. This is somebody who has struggled with mental illness, with depression, a good deal of his life. He'd also had a stroke, and he was in a very competitive race in the last election, running as a Democrat in Pennsylvania. And despite all of those things, he prevailed and he won. And he spent some time hospitalized recently for another bout of depression. And he talks openly about that struggle, but he also talks about his recovery and his process of moving on and managing his own life. And if you get the chance to have a look at that, please do, because it is incredibly moving. And it puts this particular medical issue in perspective that it is possible to recover and it is possible to work even in rarefied environments like that. So coming up next, Chief Justice John Broderick. We'll be right back.
Giving a voice to the voiceless, pulling stories out of the shadows and putting them under the spotlight, making sure that each person is valued and cared for. This is Humanity First with Peter Evers, presented by BAMZ.
Welcome back, everybody, to Humanity First. And as promised in the first section, we have a very, very special guest with us today, and somebody that I know very well and have had a friendship and a working relationship with for, I would say, the past 7 years or so. And that is, as I mentioned, Chief Justice John Broderick. John, welcome to the show. It's so lovely to have you on.
Peter, thank you. It's great to be with you. I mean that.
Well, thanks. And I know your time is very precious and you're doing so many things these days. But, you know, I thought it would be good for us to talk a little bit about some of the work that you have done over the past 7 years. We mentioned in the preamble a little bit about this idea of we are now in a position where mental health issues are discussed more broadly, more widely, and with more understanding in the workplace, and especially, as we talked about before, relative to Senator John Fetterman and the bravery that he has displayed over the past few years, and the fact that he won in Pennsylvania, despite the fact that he had of his struggles with mental health and mental illness, and the fact that he was talking about it. But your journey is a fascinating one. You know, as many people know, you were the Chief Justice of the court in New Hampshire for many, many years. And when you and I met, you had an idea. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I wish I could claim total credit for it, Peter. I'm a baby boomer, so I grew up in a world where no one talked about mental health. The idea that has captivated my life for the last 7 years was a product of a psychologist in Maryland, Barbara Van Dalen, who wanted people to know the five most common signs of a mental health problem, as well as they now know the signs of a heart attack or stroke. And because I had not recognized mental health problems in one of my own children, for which my family, and he especially, paid a high price. I was drawn to that campaign. You were one of the people that got me engaged in it. I'm always grateful for that. And it has allowed me for the last 7.5 years now to travel all over New England with the support of Dartmouth Health, speaking to 115 or 120,000 kids and 360 gyms and auditoriums. And it has opened my eyes, Peter. And this generation of young people are really extraordinary. I love them. They are something that is to behold. But a lot of them are suffering from anxiety and depression at a level that I don't remember, certainly. And after I talked about my own family and my own mistakes and the success we've had, young people have lined up to talk to this grandfather they've never met, and they open up about their own lives. And so I think for the last 7+ years, I have done what no one on earth has ever done. Not because I'm special, but because I wasn't very smart about it. I'm much smarter than now. And so I've learned a lot about this generation, and I've also learned what we, the adults, should be doing, because that's pretty important too.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is, we talked about this a little bit last night, didn't we, about what is the defining thing about this generation? And the wonderful thing is the acceptance of other people's lifestyles. We had this conversation about when single-sex marriage was actually made legal in the state of Massachusetts, and the big kerfuffle, if you like, that happened then. Now you have a conversation with somebody, with a child that's in school now, and they will say, so what? Why is this an issue? And I think as parents should be proud of that. But as parents should be listening to their children, right? And listening to what are the stresses that bring on anxiety. We know that anxiety is diagnosed in children now 4 or 5 times what it was 25 years ago. And you've really discovered that, haven't you?
I have, Peter. I've looked at the stats, and I wouldn't have believed them, but I believe them now, because I've hugged the statistics. Those statistics have faces to me now. I think this generation is so smart and worldly wise, and they are the least judgmental generation in the history of the country, and I love them for that. They want to talk about mental health in a way that no prior generation ever did. The problem they have is that oftentimes the adults in their life, who they desperately don't want to disappoint, they're not comfortable telling them. They won't tell their parents. I've had kids tell me stuff in gyms and auditoriums in places I'll never return to, what's going on in their life. And I often say to them, have you talked to your parents about it? And almost to a person, they will say, oh, I'd never tell my parents. Yeah. That's what we need to change. Yeah. And the kids are ready for it. The adults, not so much.
Can you illustrate that? Because one of the was what I mean, I know hundreds of the stories because I've been I've been with you when these things happen. But the story of the sort of big guy football player that you had, I can't remember where it was, but in a high school gym, you had talked for 45 minutes about it being okay to talk. And if you could just pick that one up, that would be great.
Well, I've talked to a lot of athletes, Peter, who when they hug you, which is pretty astounding. They're not athletes, they're just in pain. One of the first experiences I had, I gave my talk, and it was in a large high school gym. And at that point, kids started coming out to talk to me, which is pretty extraordinary, really. It's not about me, but it is about this topic. Now, when someone my age gives you permission to talk about mental health, they take it. Anyway, this young man came out. He looked like Rob Gronkowski. He was so big. And he had long hair, a baseball cap on backwards. My first thought as I was standing in the middle of the gym floor as he approached was, I hope I haven't upset this guy. And he came over to me, and he got about a foot from my face, this kid I'd never met, and his eyes were wet. And he said, can I ask you a favor? I said, sure, what? He said, can I give you a hug? And I said, you're 6'3", of course you can give me a hug. And he almost broke me in two. And then when he released me, he was crying. And he said, can I tell you my story? And so he told me. And I said to him, you may be the bravest guy I'm going to meet in my whole life. Have you told your parents? Oh, no, he said, I could never tell my parents. That's what I see and hug and hear. And mental illness has come a long way, Peter. People like you, thank God, have made a huge difference. I mean that. You're one of my heroes. But it's not the professionals who aren't doing their job. It's the rest of us who are not attentive to what's happening. And so that I don't seem righteous when I say that, I would have been one of those people. I didn't see it in my own family. So I see it now. And much of what I'm seeing and hugging can be aided substantially by awareness and no judgment. The reason young people line up, and they do, to share and hug me is they know I won't judge them or shame them or blame them. Doesn't take much more than that. And I wish every parent could be with me in those gyms. It's not about me. It's about this. And those kids are smart, and they know that I'm there for them, and I'm present and vulnerable to them because I share my own family's journey. And when you do that, kids return that favor every single time.
Yeah, and I think the impression that you make on them is remarkable. And, you know, when we think about parents not feeling as if they're armed to have that conversation because of what they went through. You know, it's funny because I think we had a conversation recently about a meme that came up for our generation. It was, did you ever tell your dad that you were sad? And the next screen comes up and says, heck no, because what, you know, you just didn't have those conversations. So, you know, we shouldn't be too hard on parents, right? Because there hasn't been a script for this. And what you're doing, I think, is giving a script both to parents and to children to be able to have that conversation. And, you know, our children now are so much more capable of saying, I need help. It's really not that unusual to hear a kid say, well, my therapist says, in the same way, perhaps, you know, 25 years ago, they would say, well, my coach says. And that, I think, is emblematic of the work that you have been doing over the past 7.5 years. And New England is very fortunate to have you. Just sort of on that theme, you are going to have an open letter to parents that is going to be published in, I think, Seacoast newspaper this Sunday. Talk a little bit about what that message is.
Yeah, I'd be happy to, Peter. After 7.5 years, I had so much confided conversation in me, and I want to share it. And when I speak to kids, they're a captive audience, so they have to be there. But they don't have to listen, but they listen because they know it's important, not because I'm doing it, but because the topic is important. Parents are harder to corral. They're too busy. They're running. And it's a topic they don't want to be identified with. So as I'm winding down, I'm still speaking wherever I'm invited, but I thought it'd be nice to put down not my thoughts, but the wisdom of kids, what they've taught me. And so I wrote the piece. It'll be published on Sunday. And frankly, not that I'm all-knowing, but it's not just a New Hampshire-centric letter. We publish in any newspaper in America. Kids are kids, parents are parents. But I wanted them to know what I've hugged and seen and experienced. And much of that could be corrected in whole or in part if everyone embraced it and everyone said, okay, my child's not perfect. My friend's child is not perfect. It's okay not to be okay. It's just no longer okay to pretend you're okay. And if we could all get to that place, we could solve a lot of these problems. Too many young people, Peter, from my conversations, are afraid of failing, whatever that means to them. They're afraid of decisions. They're afraid of disappointing their parents. We are over-organizing, over-stressing, over-competing kids. I'll tell you just a real quick story. I went to Nantucket Island a couple of years ago in the fall, and you have credibility if you go to Nantucket in November, as I say, no other reason to be here. So I spoke to kids 5th through 8th grade. I can't get this out of my head. Behind their school, it was a beautiful morning. I said, how many of you, if I could offer you an 89 on your next test, You don't have to study. You get an 89. Or I could offer you a 90, but you would have to study all night long. How many of you would study all night long? I know what I would have answered. And when I asked the question, every single hand went up. They would study all night long, fifth through eighth grade, to get one point that nobody will ever know or care about. And then when my hands went down, this boy raised his. He was a seventh grader. He said, can I ask you a question? I said, sure. What is it? He said, what would I need to do to get 100 on your test? And I thought, you should go to the beach. You're on Nantucket Island. I would have been at the beach. Not this generation. They are driven, usually by someone else's dream. And they are chasing success, building resumes. It wasn't my childhood. And most of the people who listen to this, it wasn't theirs either. Why is that happening? And what can we do about it? I think we can do a lot, but not if we don't talk about it.
Yeah, and that's the conversation is the thing. And, you know, it's funny because a decade before, John, I was on Nantucket dealing with a suicide cluster at the high school. And you and I have talked about that. And it was one of those occasions where everybody on the island, the newspapers, the schools, the police department, all came together and said, we have to stop this. What do we have to do? And it was one moment in time when people listened and we were able to manage that, but not before eight high school children had taken their own lives in what is officially a contagion suicide cluster. And Nantucket is a really good example of parents who are really pushing their children. When we talk about expectations, how do we as parents sort of ramp down those expectations? How do we take that pressure off children?
Well, let me give you an example from my own life and my own mother. When I was in high school, I went to a public high school in Massachusetts, and I didn't make the National Honor Society, which today would be the subject of a lawsuit, I'm sure. But back then, I came home and I said to my mother, hey, I didn't make the National Honor Society. My mother's response was, you'll be just fine. Okay, today my mother would say, I'm going down there, we're checking everyone's grade. Must have been the wrong formula. I did okay in life. Most of us have done okay in life. I became a lawyer because I fell in love with Perry Mason, which is a TV show.
Yeah.
Justice Sotomayor did too, by the way. It made me feel better when I learned that. we didn't know any lawyers, have any lawyers. My mother and father weren't saying, take these courses, go to law school. Get in all advanced placement classes. We are following a false path. And what we're doing to kids unintentionally, because parents love their kids as much as I love my own, but I didn't have that pressure on them. And so I think we need to understand that kids grow at different speeds. They have different interests. And there are many paths to success, which is defined differently or should be. We just need to take our foot off the gas, Peter. Be there for our children, count to them what we can, but don't try to control them. That's what's happening.
That's a wonderful point. And you just reminded me of a story about my dad, John. My dad was in the Navy, and he would come home. And when I was considering my career, I said, I'm thinking about becoming a social worker. And he looked at me and he said, does that mean you organize high society balls? And I said, no, Dad, but, you know, I'll tell you later. And followed up with him a couple of years later when I was in social work school. But yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think there's a line in your open letter, which is, and I'm going to ask you to do it, but it involves rabbits. So yes. if you could just like repeat that.
No, what I believe, Peter, is again, it's not me thinking this up in a dark room. It's the result of 7.5 years and thousands of confided conversations. I've determined that a lot of kids are chasing rabbits they'll never catch. And dreams that aren't their own. I spoke one night, I'll tell you this brief story. I spoke one night to a sophomore at Dartmouth College, and obviously she was bright. And I said to her, what really motivates you in life? And she said, what motivates me? I said, yeah, what really gets you up and going every day? She said, "You mean my hobbies?" I said, "No, no, no. What really matters to you in life?" She said, "Oh, okay. What matters to me is helping other people." And I said to her, "That's very noble. What are you doing this summer?" She's between her sophomore and junior years. She said, "I'm doing an internship at an investment bank on Wall Street." And I thought, maybe you meant helping rich people. I'm not sure. It was very clear to me, Peter, that was not her dream.
Right.
And she was doing it for a lot of external reasons, but not because she wanted to. I never had to have that conversation with my parents. They loved me and cared about me, but they also trusted me to find my way. And I think a lot of young people are being sheltered. I think we're so concerned about their safety and success, we're not willing to let them risk failure. And from that comes a lot of independence. If you try and fail, you learn something. We don't want kids to fail, even in a small way.
Right.
It's having an impact, Peter.
Yeah. And, you know, we have a thing we talk about, which is called the dignity of risk. And that is allowing people to find their own failure, to find their own way. And, you know, if you ask any human being, what did you learn more from when you succeeded or when you failed? 100% of those people are going to say, actually, it was when I failed, because this is what I learned on my own. And it's,
you know, when I was growing up, my mother would have been, if you looked up overprotective mother in the dictionary, her picture would have been there. Now, looking back to my overprotective mother, she seems marginally neglectful by today's standards. And I thought she was fabulous. But she let me breathe, and she let me choose, and she supported me when I failed. She didn't try to block the road so I could never fail.
Yeah, yeah. John, this has been, obviously, you and I could talk for hours, and we have done for so many years, but we have a couple of minutes left. But I just wanted to touch on the interview with Senator Fetterman this week, and just briefly, because you have been a well-known public figure who has stepped out of the shadows and told their story. I think it's really important that more and more people in successful positions, like, for instance, when we, you and I, actually brought a Lincoln scholar to New Hampshire Law to talk about his struggle with mental illness, and it was so powerful to hear that somebody who really forged America also struggled with his demons as well. I mean, do you see that as important, that public figures are making that kind of statement?
I think it's extraordinarily important, Peter. Senator Fetterman, I saw that interview, and very courageous to do that, especially when you're in his position. And people listen to you when they detect honesty and vulnerability. Mm-hmm. So anytime someone in public life or important in community life speaks out, in my own case, I'm no John Fetterman, but my family went through a very public time here with mental health while I was on the Supreme Court. I wouldn't have wished on another living soul. And but for Bill Gunn, who you know well, a psychologist, and you, Peter Evers, I probably wouldn't have stepped out either. But I did that, and I started talking about my own family struggles, what I didn't see, what I wished I had known. And it sent me on a 7.5-year journey. And it has been the most important work of my whole life. And anytime a child confides in a stranger like me, because I've been honest, it lets you see the impact it can have on other lives.
Yeah,
and so I think what Senator Fetterman is doing, what Michael Phelps has done, what Simone Biles has done, it's all important. Things are changing, Peter, not quickly enough for my taste, but the mainstay, by the way, of all of this, and I mean this sincerely, are people like you. I always wondered how valuable people were that did what you did. I don't wonder that anymore. I wonder why we don't have more of you. And I think I know why, too. But we as a community need to recognize this is an everywhere, everyday problem. It affects 1 in 5 people, and most of it is treatable.
Absolutely. Chief Justice John Broderick, I really appreciate you coming on. And your actions have absolutely improved the environment that children are growing up in New England. There is no doubt about that. You should be incredibly proud of the work you've done. And I am incredibly proud to be associated with a tiny piece of that. So
let's have one request. If you could make me 30 years younger, I could do it longer.
That one might be out of my hands. And by the way, if I had that, I'd do it for myself.
Anyway, no, always fun to be with you. And thanks for what you do every day. I mean that, Peter.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you for coming on the show, John. And take care. Goodbye, everybody.